Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Test Talks. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com, and this is a podcast for anyone who wants to discover how to succeed with testing and automation, as well as what works for testing any software development project. Today, I'm inviting you to join me in the Test Automation Kitchen as Rob Frizzell, author of the PhantomJS Cookbook, gets ready to serve us some tasty PhantomJS automation awesomeness. We'll be sampling some of his most popular recipes and discovering how to succeed with PhantomJS. Hey Rob, welcome to Test Talks.
Hi Joe, thanks for having me.
So Rob, before we get started, could you just tell us a little bit more about yourself?
I am a front-end developer by trade, and I have been at Dealer.com for a little over 11 years. I have been a front-end engineer there for about the past 6 years. Prior to that, I was managing the production department there. Prior to that, I was managing the support team there. I'm a big fan of working in the browser. JavaScript is my native language, so to speak. You know, I do dabble a little bit in Java, a little bit in Groovy, you know, primarily a front-end developer there. About this time last year, I started work on PhantomJS Cookbook, which came out earlier this year from Pact Publishing.
Awesome. Yeah, I'd like to start off by talking about your book, PhantomJS Cookbook. But before we do, in a nutshell, what is PhantomJS?
Sure. So at one time, I would have said that PhantomJS is like Chrome without the Chrome. But now that Chrome is using Blink as its rendering engine underneath, that's become less true. So now it's more like, you know, Safari without the Chrome. It's a headless web browser. It uses WebKit as the rendering engine underneath. I'm actually not sure what it's using for the JavaScript interpreter and the CSS interpreter. The important bit, the part that most people focus in on, is the fact that PhantomJS is a headless build of WebKit. I believe it's wrapped with Qt, and it's a command line tool for doing web stuff. So pulling in web pages, running the tests on them, scraping, just about anything you can do in a browser, you can do with PhantomJS.
Awesome. So in order to interact with the API, is it straight JavaScript that you would use?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a JavaScript API that you use to script the browser. So if you were using Safari or Chrome or something like that, of course, you're clicking around. But with PhantomJS, you write a little script, and it takes the place of those clicks. So you know, you have your scripts. They're asynchronous for the most part. So you have, you know, a lot of callbacks there as you wait for latency-intensive operations to complete, like loading web pages or loading resources for those web pages. Just a whole JavaScript API. You write a little script. You run it from the command line.
What was the main reason for you writing the PhantomJS cookbook?
The main reason that I wrote it was there's a lot of resources that are out there, but they're scattered. The API is pretty well documented on the website, and there's a bunch of good threads in the Google groups, and there's a bunch of good threads on Stack Overflow, and there's a bunch of good tools around it, but they were all over the place, you know. And if you are just getting started trying to build out a testing strategy for your web application, it can be a little intimidating, a little daunting, and kind of time consuming to go out there and try to put all of these things together. I use it in my work every day. All of my builds go through at least some level of unit testing, and the front end layer is being processed through PhantomJS. This is a tool that I've been using for a couple of years, and this is a tool that I've been pretty excited about, and I've given a couple of talks on it at local meetups and local conferences. And actually, I gave a talk at a local conference that actually is what turned into the book. So I got contacted by Pact October or November of 2013, and they said, hey, you know, we have this idea about trying to do a similar thing, and it looks like you are at this subject pretty extensively, and would you be interested? And so we got to talking, and it just seemed like a great opportunity to put out one good go-to resource where somebody who was just cutting their teeth on PhantomJS could just grab a hold of it and get going with it.
Awesome. Yeah, I want to repeat, it is a great go-to resource. It's one of the few out there. I'm not really fluent in JavaScript, or I never used PhantomJS, and I was able to pick up your book and pretty much get up and running. And I don't think I was the target audience, and I still was able to use it as a go-to resource and get up and running.
Yeah, I think the reason that I called that out in the introduction there is that I feel like there are a lot of books out there that spend the first chapter or two sort of not books that are specific to PhantomJS, but books that might be talking about this JavaScript framework or this JavaScript library or something like that. And they spend a chapter or two just sort of going over what JavaScript is and how it works. And I wanted to skip that. I wanted to go right into the meat of it and focus on, like, I didn't want to spend a lot of time talking about, oh, well, these are the core APIs of JavaScript. No, I wanted to go right into, these are the core PhantomJS APIs.
I agree. So someone would have to have some sort of programming background, be somewhat familiar with JavaScript, I think, and I think they would be fairly comfortable reading the book and following along.
Yeah, I hope so.
So, Rob, what's your favorite or most popular recipe in your book?
I actually wound up spending very little time on the CasperJS piece. I think there are three recipes in the functional testing chapter that talk about CasperJS. And since the book's come out, most of the conversations that I've had with people have really been about using CasperJS on top of PhantomJS, either to run screen scraping utilities or automatic screen capture scripts or functional test suites. When we were speccing out the book last year, this wasn't something that was really on my radar. I mean, it was, but I was really focused more on unit tests and unit testing. And so I was really surprised that there was so much interest in functional testing afterward. That was a big surprise. And I wish I had covered it in more depth. But it also has a pretty well-documented API. So I think at least there's the foundational pieces in there for other people. But I've given two talks since the book came out that were focused on CasperJS.
Are there any recipes that you cover in PhantomJS Cookbook that you think most people using PhantomJS may not be aware of?
So there's an interesting story there. So I think I have two answers to this. And the first is that when I was first pitching the book, one of the recipes I proposed was, you know, how to deal with WebSockets in PhantomJS. And I don't know where I had gotten the idea that WebSockets were even exposed as one of the PhantomJS APIs. I think I just kind of took it for granted that they would be there. And so when I got to the part where I began writing, hey, here's how you would unit test JavaScript that interacts with WebSockets, I found it was actually, you know, you could really only test them indirectly. And I had a bit of egg on my face as I was going back and forth with the editor, saying like, well, I'm not going to give up, but this is not as straightforward as I thought it was going to be. One thing that has come up is that I definitely, the WebSocket support is there, but it's buried and it's definitely not exposed. And the only way to really test interaction with the WebSockets is indirectly. The technical reviewer feedback definitely reflected that was not what people were expecting when they arrived at that recipe. I think the other thing that people are not really aware of is that it's I feel like there's a lot of questions out there, like on Stack Overflow and a bunch of other threads about really trying to do batch operations with PhantomJS. I don't really cover this in depth in the book now that I think of it. The scripts are pretty much one-shot deals, and so if you wanted to loop through a bunch of different URLs, you can wind up in a sort of an awkward place trying to maybe, you know, wrap PhantomJS with an additional shell script or something to try to do something like that. And I feel like there's this perception among folks who are new to the utility that, oh, I can just feed a bunch of stuff to it and it'll just loop through. I know that I certainly, when I was new to the utility, it was an expectation that I had. And I guess as an aside to that, one thing that I mention in the book that I try to highlight to people is that as it's a command line utility, it is a good Unix citizen. So you can exit with a 0 or 1 status code and have that be meaningful for things like, you know, the scripts that you write that wrap it, or if you use it in a continuous integration environment.
My job basically focuses on, I think most of my listeners, is functional test automation using, you know, end-to-end automation using tools like Selenium. So what do you mainly use PhantomJS for in your day-to-day job?
I'm a front-end engineer by trade, by design, by desire. But what I've found over the course of my career is that unit testing in particular has been a lifesaver in particular. And so the main thing that we have used PhantomJS for is coming up with, you know, a battery of unit tests that we can run against code changes so that as we're committing new code, as we're delivering new code, that we have a high degree of confidence that what we're adding or changing to the system is not, you know, having these adverse downstream effects my focus originally in working with Phantom.js and in the testing that I'm writing day to day is typically unit tests to hopefully catch a lot of this stuff before it gets downstream to where the functional tests are going to pick up some of those tests or, you know, test errors or regressions. We are starting to look at more functional test stuff. At our company, we do have a couple of test automation engineers who are focused on writing, you know, comprehensive functional test batteries to run against the application and against the websites that the application supports. I've got a pretty good relationship with them. We actually have had a lot of conversations about things like, what are the best kinds of unit tests that we can put in place to try to prevent those kinds of regressions? And then we're also looking at having the individual scrum teams at the organization start to write some of their own functional tests and support some of their own functional tests so that as those features that those teams are responsible for, as those start bubbling up to the system-wide functional tests, those end-to-end tests, that we start minimizing the regressions that the test automation team is seeing.
Awesome. Yeah, I definitely agree. I think I try to encourage our developers to do more unit testing. And if they did more unit testing, we would be able to do less end-to-end regression tests. It takes longer. And sometimes it's better if you go down a level to do a unit test, which is quicker and faster and more focused.
It's interesting. It's a balancing act, right? Because you have a lot of things that if you can catch them at the unit test level, it's not that there's no need to test for those things at the functional or end-to-end test level, but it minimizes your exposure. And as you pointed out, it's typically a lot faster to run those unit tests. But that being said, there are certainly a lot of things where you need to get to that functional level to where you've put all the pieces of the application together to really see some of those things. And I've got to say, like, even within the last week or so, we had something like that. You know, we saw something that went out, and we're like, whoa, you know, if we'd had just this one simple test would have caught this and would have prevented that little incident.
Can you give us an example? I know you can't get details.
Yeah, we had one specific case where, so part of the business model that we have is to white label the solution. And so there was one particular place where if these specific set of circumstances aligned in one of the white label scenarios, then a login page was not appearing. It was a pretty big thing. You know, it was one of those days where there were a lot of people rushing to get patch out. We all slapped our heads and went, man, how is this? How did we not catch this before? So needless to say, test got written.
How often do you use Phantom.js then in day-to-day, your day-to-day workflow?
For me, it is pretty deeply entrenched in my workflow. I'm using it pretty much every day. The team that I'm on is largely responsible for a bunch of frameworks and infrastructure. So my customers are the other developers in the organization. And so, I mean, this is true of anybody, right? No one wants to make a commit and have it not work. But there are just disastrous consequences if I screw something up. I am then having to go and tell developers on every team, whoops, I goofed, and I know I just asked you to update a library, but now I need you to update it again. So I never could bring myself to go all the way to a test-driven development style, but I don't release anything to the other developers in the organization without having put, I mean, our team's target is 80% or greater unit test coverage on what we've written. We're trying to be very thoughtful and very diligent about taking what we've written and putting, you know, good coverage around it. And the way that Phantom.js fits into that is I'm trying to get that unit test coverage on all of that JavaScript that I'm releasing to the rest of the organization. Phantom.js is not by itself a test framework, but it's cumbersome to, you know, write a suite of Jasmine tests and then load it up into Chrome and then load it up into Firefox and load it up in all these different places. It is not enough to just run it through Phantom.js and say, hey, all of my tests pass and move on. But it is a really good canary in the coal mine. It's that sort of 80-20 rule, right? If you get good coverage, if you, like 80% or greater unit test coverage over your code branches or your line coverage, you can have a pretty high degree of confidence that if the tests are passing in Phantom.js, there's a really good chance that they're going to pass in the other browsers. You know, that's not always true. The sort of famous example at the office is that the trim method on the string prototype in JavaScript doesn't exist in, I think it's versions of Internet Explorer 8 and below. And so if you've got code that's depending on that being there, your tests are going to pass in Phantom.js, but they're not going to pass when they hit Internet Explorer. And so it's not going to provide total coverage, but it is going to give you a high degree of confidence that at least most things are working the way that you would expect them in all of the places that you do need to provide that support.
What I'm hearing is it makes for a really great sanity test almost when someone checks in code and you get quick feedback from your CI right away to say, did I break anything? And then you may kick off your longer running front end test and get that feedback. But
absolutely.
Awesome. Is there one thing you see over and over again in your experience that most people creating front end test automation are doing wrong?
You know, I would say that it's a pretty mixed bag. I just alluded to how PhantomJS is really more of a sanity check than anything else. But I feel like that there's a lot of people who get started using it with their tests and wind up getting that sort of false confidence. And so they say, well, I've got this battery of tests and they're passing in PhantomJS and that's enough. And when I wind up in those conversations with folks, I try to remind them, you know, like I just told my anecdote about string.trim. And anecdotes like that are a good reminder that this is a great place to start, but it's not a cure-all. And then I would say that the other mistake that I see people make is just sort of like to test for testing's sake without really being thoughtful about the tests that they're writing. And this is not specific to people that are writing tests for JavaScript. I would say that this is a mistake that a lot of the developers that are not being thoughtful about the unit tests that they're writing, this is kind of the test that they're making, right? It's like, I wrote unit tests and it's a box and you check it and you say, I have X percent coverage and I'm good to go. Not really using the code coverage tool and then really doing a thoughtful analysis of like, what have you actually tested and have you actually done the edge cases? And, you know, there was that tweet that went around, well, I guess about 2 weeks ago, about a QA engineer walks into a bar and orders a beer, orders 10 beers, orders no beers, orders just minus one beers, or, you know, orders a skunk. And it's funny, right? And if you go through the reply thread, like it gets really hilarious about the kinds of edge cases that are brought into this joke. But I think it's really true that it's not enough to say, oh, well, I'm going to test for these things. If you just test for your basic expectations, you're going to validate what you already know. You've got to really think about, what do I really need to test? How is somebody going to break this? Kind of two stories I like to tell, right? So first is a project that we just wrapped up. We did the code coverage analysis on what we'd just written, or what we were writing tests on. It had like, I want to say like, let's go with like 70% line coverage, right? And so we start looking at the line by line analysis. So we use Covertura for analyzing Java and the Groovy code, and then we use Istanbul for analyzing, doing the code coverage analysis on the JavaScript code. This particular bit of code, looking at it, and we've got 70% line coverage, and we're like, okay, well, what tests do we need to write to get to our 80% goal? And as we start going through, what it occurred to us was that it wasn't that we needed to add tests. It was that we had a bunch of lines in there for scenarios that just didn't even make sense. Like, we're testing that a parameter is going to be a certain value or is going to be present, but, you know, it was not exposed. And so there's no way that it could be called that way. And so we never say never, but given the way the code was structured, the way that we got to 80% was by actually removing blocks of code that were effectively unreachable. And then, of course, my other anecdote that I like to tell people is what really got me interested in writing tests was a bit of code that I was responsible for in an internally written framework that was responsible for handling, of course, dates, right? Everybody loves to test dates. We kept running into situations over and over and over again where it was like, well, this isn't working, and why? Well, that's because it's the end of the month, and the calculation is only doing, you know, minus 30 days, and it's like, well, of course that's not going to work. There's only however many months in a year that have 30 days. You start running through all of the possible scenarios, right? Like, I want to look at last month, and last month, how many days are in last month? And so just, like, running through all those scenarios and, you know, doing stuff like month to date and over the past year. And I can't remember the saying now, but it's like, you know, nobody hates a date like a programmer hates a date.
The two main points I want to tease out of that I think relate to any type of automation, and that is the false confidence factor and the checkbox factor.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've seen this with all kinds of automation, and it kind of scares me because I have managers that say we want 100% automation. It's like, are you insane? Our developers, we have developers that are offshore. They have a checkbox. They're going to check that off. Yeah, I'm done with all my automation. But it's not quality automation. And anyway, so I definitely agree with your two points about the false confidence and making sure that it's not just a checkbox at the end of your sprint. Yep, got our automation test. we're done.
Yes.
So do you recommend any JavaScript development tools?
So the first thing that I would throw out there is, again, you know, I mentioned we're primarily our operations, our developments, primarily in the JVM. So I, when I'm at work, I spend my entire day in IntelliJ IDEA, and it's got, you know, a great ecosystem of plugins to support a lot of front-end utilities. And the reason I'm using IntelliJ is because I'm going to need to context switch from JavaScript to Java or JavaScript to Groovy from time to time. And so that minimizes the friction. But when I'm hacking on, you know, side projects at home, or when I was writing a PhantomJS cookbook, I was in WebStorm, which is the front-end focused product by JetBrains. So, you know, IntelliJ IDEA is JetBrains' flagship IDE, and then WebStorm is their front-end, you know, HTML5 and JavaScript IDE. I think that's a great tool. When I am just sort of hacking out something just really fast, I'll use my sort of text editor flavor of the week, right? I use TextMate and or Sublime and or Atom, kind of depending on what did I use last and what am I just trying to get through. Most of the time, it winds up being Sublime Text. And I like the Sublime REPL package, which hooks into any of the REPLs that might be out there. So I use it, you know, if I'm hacking on like a JavaScript project, I'll kind of do the split screen in Sublime and have my file that I'm working on the left. And then I've got like a Node.js REPL on the right. So I can just sort of like hack through an idea real quick or to kind of validate some of my assumptions there. A great unit testing tool. And this is one that I've got a couple of recipes in the cookbook that are dedicated to this, but the Karm Test Runner. And this is from the guys at Google that are working on AngularJS as well. I think I can't remember their names off the top of my head. But Karma Test Runner, oh man, has just changed the way I do testing. Before Karma Test Runner, I was manually keeping track of, you know, I had like an HTML file that was the test runner. And I was like, you know, going through and like putting the source files in and putting in the test files and putting in the libraries to support it. And like, if it needed any fixtures, putting those in there, a lot of maintenance for that. And then just trying to like go and figure out what are the best kind of, you know, tools to wrap it. Once I found out about Karma, the awesome thing about Karma is you've got a little config file, a JavaScript based config file. And you say, this is where my source files live. These are where my libraries are. This is where my test files are. It takes care of the rest, right? Like it takes care of putting together what fixtures are. It builds the HTML file around that, around the manifest that you provide it. And, you know, you specify in that config file, like this is the test library that we're using. And if you specify whether or not you want to do code coverage, you specify whether or not you need to run a preprocessor, like a CoffeeScript preprocessor. And then you just, on the command line, you're just karma run and then the name of the config file, and it just runs it. And the other great thing too with Karma is like you can keep like multiple config files going. So you can have a config file that, you know, you set up a watcher, you know, that sits there. So you've got your project and you're hacking on your project, and you can just like flip back to the terminal and watch as like the tests keep re-executing in PhantomJS. And then you can have like a parallel config file that knows that it's targeting CI, right? So that config file is then the one that's going to run, you know, you push to Travis CI or you push to your Jenkins CI, and it runs the PhantomJS tests, and it runs, spawns off, you know, Firefox and spawns off Chrome and spawns off Internet Explorer instance or something. And Karma is just an awesome, awesome tool for running unit tests. Lastly, I briefly mentioned Casper.js earlier in our discussion. Yep. And I want to say that even a year ago, I was just kind of so-so on it. Any of the code that I was writing that was targeting PhantomJS is pretty much just naked PhantomJS API. But I really have come to appreciate Casper.js as a tool. It does a really fantastic job of abstracting away a lot of the asynchronous stuff that you're dealing with when you're dealing with PhantomJS scripts. And the cool thing about Casper is find the code highly readable. I actually just did a 30-minute session. I think it was last week, one of the QA engineers at the office. This is like the first code that she's written I'm pretty sure that's what she told me. This is the first code I've written, she said. And she had some pretty effective Casper.js functional tests that she'd written. I was impressed. I said, you know, that's fantastic. So it makes writing the test easy. It's a great way for people who don't necessarily have strong technical backgrounds to get started. And it's just a fantastic tool for functional tests, for doing stuff like automating screenshots and things like that.
Are there any resources or books you would recommend to someone to learn JavaScript or PhantomJS or unit testing?
So, well, mine, obviously.
Right, absolutely.
Obviously. So I'd like to think that my book not only shows you how to use Phantom.js, but also has good, just sort of good testing practices in a more general way. That somebody who maybe hasn't done any JavaScript unit testing in the past or has only really done a little bit, if they follow along with the recipes in the cookbook, they're gonna see not only how to use Phantom.js, but sort of just good testing practices, good coding practices. Other books I would recommend, again, I'm a front end guy mainly, so these are going to be JavaScript books. So Nicholas Zakas put out a book a couple years ago called Maintainable JavaScript, which is just a fantastic book about how to write code, JavaScript code that's going to scale, JavaScript code that's going to be great, you know, easily digested by other members of the team, code that's testable, how to test some of that code. It's a much more broad book. I've recommended that book to a lot of people. On the flip side of that, so Angus Krall just put out a book called If Hemingway Wrote JavaScript, which is a really interesting book. I love that book, where he has a series of interesting sort of computer science problems and then has a bunch of different JavaScript solutions as he imagines that it would have been solved by Ernest Hemingway or David Foster Wallace, or I don't think Kurt Vonnegut's in there, Emily Bronte. So different literary figures from throughout history, and just to sort of show sort of the quirks of the language and how expressive the language can be. And although I would not necessarily say that you should always write code like the code that appears in this book, it's a really interesting look at the language and a lot of the design decisions that were at play and a lot of the interesting quirks that are in there. So that's a really interesting JavaScript book. And then Ethan Trostler has a great book called Testable JavaScript. I think I read an early access version of it, so I don't know that. I don't believe I read the final cut of it, but that one's good. That one's a good look at how to write JavaScript that you can actually write tests against. James Coughlin just self-published a book, JavaScript Testing Recipes. You know, it's a little bit of a specious recommendation since I haven't read this one. He's a really critical thinker, and I really admire him. And so I'm going to recommend it, even though I haven't read it. So with that caution, I'm going to add that book to the list.
Awesome. So I'm going to have a link to all these resources in the show notes at testtalks.com/24.
Great.
So Rob, just so you know, Phantom.js cookbook, people can head on out to Amazon or Packet Publishing and easily grab it.
Yep. It's
very affordable.
Yep.
I definitely give it a 5-star review.
Why, thank you.
Like I said, it's all in one resource. Rather than go out on the internet and have to research it, you've done all the work for us. We could just go to this one place now and get started fairly quickly, I think, mm-hmm. and pretty much cover all the functionality that's available within Phantom.js.
Yeah. And like I said, with my little anecdote about the WebSockets there, maybe even some of the stuff where you shouldn't be.
Cool. So, Rob, before we go, is there one piece of actionable advice you can give someone trying to improve their Phantom.js automation efforts? And let us know the best way to find or contact you.
So the advice I would give is not specific to Phantom.js, but it is some advice that I think I mentioned, you know, earlier in the talk, but it's to not look at your tests as, you know, just a checkbox, but to really take a step back and ask, what am I actually trying to test? There's business value. There's real actual business value in those tests, and to ask what the business value of those tests are and what it is about the feature that you're really trying to put under the microscope. So that would be my advice. For people that want to reach out to me, I am FoundDrama on Twitter, and I'm pretty active there. So if you want to get in touch with me, Twitter is probably the best way. And I look forward to speaking with y'all.
Awesome. Thanks again, Rob. This was an excellent interview. I think it's going to add a lot of value for people that are unfamiliar with Phantom.js to get them up and running. So thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me, Joe.
If you like what you hear on Test Talks, head on over to testtalks.com and click on the subscribe and iTunes icon. Leave, hopefully, a 5-star review, and I will give you a personal shout-out at the beginning of an upcoming episode. And as always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.